This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the first week of August, typically the dumbest month of the year, and this week lawmakers appear to have made little progress toward a deal to extend economic aid related to the coronavirus crisis. We also got a jobs report on Friday showing that job growth continued in July, albeit at a much slower pace than in May and June. The U.S. economy added 1.8 million jobs in July, though that number includes some seasonal adjustments that don't really make sense in the time of coronavirus. The report credits public schools with a big gain because they didn't have the usual layoffs that you see in a normal July. Of course, they didn't have those usual July layoffs because they were already closed. And so without that seasonal adjustment, the report shows 600,000 jobs added. This is another data point showing the economy is stalling out, but not so far shrinking again. But how long will that continue in the face of two economic threats, a coronavirus situation that continues to be poor, and an economy that is losing government support that kept it afloat through the spring? To talk about that, I want to bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Megan McArdle, columnist of the Washington Post on the right, and on the left, Dorian Warren, president of the Center for Community Change. Hello.
Hey there. Great to be back with you, Josh.
Greetings and salutations.
Our special guest this week is Betsy Stevenson. Betsy is a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan. Formerly, she served on President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, and she was the chief economist at the Department of Labor. Hello, Betsy.
Hi, great to talk with you.
Betsy, I'm really glad to have you this week because you previously led the economists at the department that produces these jobs reports. How should we interpret the report that we got this week? How is the job situation?
Well, I think that the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been really incredibly transparent and forthright about how they're collecting data, the problems they're running into, and what they're doing. So I think let's just give some kudos to them. But if you look at the report, I think it's exactly what you said. We're sort of treading water right now. We had a suppression at the where we sent a bunch of people home, and we've lifted that suppression and brought some of those people back. But in the midst of all that, there's been a lot of permanent job loss. This report was positive in the sense that there wasn't much of an increase in permanent job loss. It basically was flat. And so I think of that as this report shows that there's not much of a recovery right now, but perhaps the decline has actually, you know, has actually stopped. I'm hesitating right now just because, you know, I just keep hearing reports of companies that are what they like to call right-sizing, looking at their revenue stream and saying, we can't support this payroll. That right-sizing is continuing to create permanent layoffs. So I'm not sure we're fully at the bottom, but this report made me a little bit more optimistic than I was before it came out.
Megan, the president said this is a good report. Does this report make you feel good?
No. It doesn't make me feel terrible, right? I think that it certainly could have been worse. But I think what it reinforces for me is how badly we have failed at virus control, which is ultimately recession control in this situation. And, you know, everyone, not that we shouldn't be doing economic relief packages, there's a lot in both what Democrats and Republicans are proposing that I support. But ultimately, our biggest weapon to bring the economy back is just getting the virus under control. And that's where we're failing over and over and over again. And that's, I think, what you see in the jobs report is that there's just a bunch of economic activity that functionally cannot resume until we have gotten this to a point where it is safe for people to go out again. We sort of uniquely among developed nations, certainly, we are worst in class on that front. You know, I look at this and I think, okay, well, it's not a total disaster, but it's a pretty big disaster. And I think what I worry about is what Betsy talks about, you know, coming down the pike is the people who are maybe treading water right now, but sort of reluctantly coming to the conclusion that it's time to start shedding workers. And so I'm this does not make me optimistic for what I had hoped for early on would be a V-shaped recovery.
And Dorian, what do you think?
I agree with Megan. You know, we are still almost 13 million jobs below where we were in February, and the unemployment rate is still greater than what we saw in the Great Recession. I'm really particularly concerned with the racial disparities here in terms of the Black unemployment rate, which is around 14.6%. For Hispanics, it's 12.9%. So I'm very, very concerned about the continuing slow recovery. And I'm also discouraged by the fact that there is no real solution on the table in terms of Washington. You know, like even Trump and the Senate Republicans can't get their act together to figure out how they align on a plan to negotiate with the Democrats. And the consequence of that is that millions of people who are still suffering will continue to suffer, especially as we know rent was due on August 1st and evictions are starting. So there's just so much pain and suffering. And, you know, from where I sit in Washington, games are being played with people's lives right now. So I'm very discouraged.
Betsy, what would have to happen for job growth to get stronger again, to start seeing reports like we saw in May and June? I mean, I think, you know, I think we're all in agreement that the most important thing here is the virus situation. It looks like maybe we're starting to see some improvement on that. Hospitalizations have started to fall again nationally. They're still rising in certain places. They're still significantly above the levels where they were in late June. But I think a lot of people looked at this report and were sort of surprised to see continued job growth in restaurants, in healthcare, and other service sectors that had been really battered in March and April. And sort of suggesting that that people are on net going back to work in those. Could we see that even accelerate a little bit if things, you know, even if things don't get as good from a virus situation as they ought to be, even if they don't get as good as we're seeing in Europe, the modest improvements that we're seeing, is that something that might be a reason for optimism about what we're going to see in next month's report?
So, you know, I agree with Megan that the economy, what's happening in the economy is about what's happening with the virus. And I think that the, you know, the question is, have we seen real improvements in the virus since the July reference week?
The reference week is the week including July 12th. So the report, it doesn't show us jobs at the end of July. It shows us jobs as of the middle of July.
So, you know, I don't think we've seen a lot of improvement in the virus since then. I don't think we're ever going to see reports like, particularly like the June report. Those were the easy jobs to bring back. I think that people are now, you know, at the place where it's just not clear that everything's reopening. You know, one example I like to look at is dentist's offices, because, you know, they had a huge backlog. Their employment was massively down because many states required dentist's offices to close. And we saw huge gains in May and June as the offices reopened, brought people back, started rescheduling cleaning, fillings, all sorts of treatments that people had put off. But employment is still down 6% from where it was a year ago. We normally think 6% decline in employment in an industry is huge. And I don't really see a big resurgence in employment in dentist's office going increasing until the virus is even under greater control. So I wanted to say, you know, I said this report made me feel a little bit more optimistic. And that's kind of a weird thing to say when you're looking at 10 to 11% unemployment, you know, sort of depending on which measure you use. I'm optimistic because, you know what? All that money we put out through stimulus payments, through the unemployment insurance checks, it worked. We boosted incomes, people spent money, and companies tried to bring as many people back as they could. People weren't reluctant to go back to work because they had those UI payments. So if this sends any message to Congress, I hope it's that, you know, when you boost incomes, it works to keep the economy afloat, and they need to get that next stimulus round passed.
So let's talk about the situation in Washington, where it seems like there wasn't really any progress toward that this week. The president is openly frustrated by the amount of leverage that Democrats perceive themselves as having in these negotiations, and Democrats have been pretty inflexible regarding their demands on the size of the package. They're looking for around $3 trillion. And so the president has come up with this idea that he's going to issue some executive orders, maybe, trying to say that he'll do a relief package through his own powers so he won't need Congress. Some of the ideas that have been floated are suspending collection of payroll taxes. The president doesn't have the legal authority to cut or forgive those taxes, but he can delay collection. There's talk about maybe trying to scrounge up some money that's been appropriated for other things and use it to do some sort of enhancement to unemployment benefits. Actually, I want to start with Betsy, what you make of this policy process, because certainly, I mean, this is very unusual for the president to try to do these sorts of things under his own power. It's the sort of, you know, it's a great extension on the extensions that Obama was conducting that Republicans were so angry about at that time. Is there an executive branch fix for this? And what is the consequence to the extent that Congress continues to be unable to reach a deal?
You know, I think executive branch fixes are always, you know, last resort efforts when Congress is just refusing to cooperate. I think I'm disappointed in the stalemate. I think it would be better for Congress to reach a deal than you know, for Trump to be pushing, you know, the power, his authority as far as it can legally go, you know, but it's frustrating if you're in the White House because you don't, it's not about you. It's really the Republicans and Democrats in Congress that have to come to some sort of agreement here. And, you know, it's the, we're talking about unemployment insurance checks coming right before an election. I think the Democrats feel like they can't let go of that issue. Frankly, I think some Republicans should feel that they should be pushing for that those payments, because when people are broke, when they're getting evicted, it's not good for anybody's reelection prospects.
Dorian, I feel like there's been a bit of a disconnect between the very real stories about individual households facing really serious financial strain, both from the fundamental economic situation itself and from a lot of the difficulties that have that we've had getting unemployment checks out. You see all these stories about people who have been calling and calling their state unemployment office for months. And then what you see in the aggregate data, which is that incomes actually went up in the spring, even as so many people were put out of work. Consumer spending in areas where spending was possible was remarkably strong. Household savings were very high. Banks were reporting that balances in accounts had gone up very quickly as people received this money and were not spending most of it yet. And so that makes me wonder, you know, as Betsy notes, you don't want to be sort of cutting off stimulus to the economy in a recession as you're coming out of a recession leading up to an election. But it makes me wonder about how quickly we're actually going to see that at the macroeconomic level. I mean, you do have a lot of households that have a lot more savings than they usually would. And I don't know the extent to which Democrats can count on the idea that cutting off the unemployment checks today is going to show up, you know, immediately in economic activity. Now, obviously, people have excellent reasons to be nervous and to not spend money even if they have it. But I think that I think the broader economic picture has been a little bit better through this process than people would have expected just looking at those individual household stories.
Yeah, I think we have to look at the data, the macro data, and the stories of real people together, Josh. And that's partly what we count on our political process to do, right, is to tether members of Congress to their districts so they can actually hear from their constituents about what they're going through and offer some solutions on the table that would fix those problems, right? Whether it's, as we know, the unemployment insurance, expanded unemployment insurance ended at the end of July, eviction moratoriums ended at the end of July. So we're now, in a sense, in a natural experiment about what's going to happen to ordinary people around, and millions of ordinary people. And we're gonna have a conversation soon about childcare, which is a big part of this too. But let me go back to the original question around what is the path out of this. And I think there's four ways. I think first, Trump or Senate Republicans could feel some pressure to act, and Republicans come back to the table. We actually need some leadership here. We need the president to actually lead his party. Otherwise, we're going to continue to be mired in this mediocrity and incompetence, frankly. Second, the Democrats could cave and pass something very small, frankly, that won't solve the scale of the problem like we did with the CARES Act. Third, we have a forcing event with the September 30th deadline around government funding. So that could push both parties, both the Republican Party, to get aligned, because they're not aligned, and push them to the table with the Democrats to negotiate something. And then fourth is maybe nothing happens until January 20th. And that is a scenario that I don't want to imagine, but it's very possible. And if we do nothing until then, the harm and pain in this country, and frankly, I think the protest around the inaction in Washington will grow much larger.
It's funny, Megan, I've also been thinking about that September 30th date. That's also when the aid to the airlines runs out, and there's been a push with significant support on both sides of the aisle in Congress to do something to reauthorize that. But September 30 is 8 weeks away. And, you know, I mean, Republicans used to talk a lot about the cost of uncertainty to the economy, making people wait 8 more weeks, both individuals and businesses, without knowing what the policy is going to be. You would think that that would have significant negative effects in the meantime.
Oh, I mean, this is madness. I think there's some madness on the Democratic side, too. You know, it takes two people to have a deadlock. The Democrats could have accepted the Republican offer, and they haven't. And the Republican offer is not that crazy. I mean, you know, $400 a week in unemployment benefit, extra unemployment benefits instead of $600 is probably not going to by itself crash the economy. I would also say that the difference between those two things is not worth crashing the economy. And I think that the big risk has always been that we have this really weird recession. It's just not like any other recession we've ever had, right? And a lot of the old stuff that you hear people talking about, oh, get, you know, money into workers' hands because they spend it. Well, you know, yeah, but there's not a lot to spend it on right now, which is why savings is going up. You know, we're in uncharted territory. But the risk is that we have a normal recession on top of the COVID contraction. And that's something that we're now flirting with, I think.
We've talked a lot about the short-term effects of this crisis on the job market and on the economy, but a lot of what's happening in this crisis is likely to stick with us for a pretty long time. Children are missing school. That may affect the kind of work they can do when they grow up and their educational attainment. Parents' lives have been turned upside down by the need for new childcare arrangements. That affects their own work. Let's take a break, and then I want to come back and talk about those issues with Dorian Warren of the Center for Community Change, Megan McArdle of the Washington Post, and Betsy Stevenson of the University of Michigan. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist of the Washington Post. On the left is Dorian Warren, president of the Center for Community Change. And our special guest is Betsy Stevenson, professor at the University of Michigan, former chief economist at the Department of Labor, and an economic advisor to President Obama. So as we've been having this debate over economic relief, we're also having all of these debates at the state and local level about how and whether to reopen schools. There's this teenager from Georgia who was suspended for posting photos on social media of the crowded hallways at her high school, where many students were not wearing masks. There are also jurisdictions where case counts are low, and I think parents, frankly, have very valid complaints that the schools are not opening up as much as they should be. But I feel like a lot of these conversations are so focused on the near term, they're glossing over the huge consequences of these decisions that's going to go well beyond the pandemic. The effects on educational achievement for students being kept out of school for so long, how needing to provide so much more childcare for so long will affect parents' work and careers. Betsy, I know this is something you've been thinking about a lot. Let's start with the parents. What does it mean for our economy that school closures and childcare closures are pushing so many parents into stay-at-home parenting?
I think that we have yet to really see the effects of those decisions and the choices that parents are being forced to make. And I think we will see them for years to come. So let's think about how caregiving normally affects the labor market experience of caregivers. It results in people taking maybe a period of time out of the labor market. When we study those periods of time out of the labor market, they put people on completely different trajectories where they never go on to earn as much as they would have earned had they not taken that spell out of the labor market. Sometimes they turn down a promotion. That also puts them on a different trajectory. Sometimes they take a job which has a shorter commute or is just going to be a better fit for their family. Both men and women, one in two parents say they've turned down a job in the past because it didn't work with their family. So I think what we're now going to see is just a lot of decisions within families that result in lower earnings, lower labor force attachment, and sort of worse fits with their work because they're trying to make things fit for their family. And I have to say, a lot of people, I get some criticism that I say this word choices a lot. It's not the problem that they're making choices. The problem is that you know, their options are terrible and they have no choice but to sometimes make really difficult choices that are going to have long-lasting negative impacts on their careers. And I really think that we will still be dealing with this in, you know, in several years and maybe in several decades as we try to figure out, you know, how do we reintegrate people who've taken time out of the labor market back in? How do we get people back on paths that were similar to where they were before? And it's just not clear we're ever going to accomplish that. It's kind of like the person who graduates in a recession, you know, they takes them more than a decade to ever have quite the career of the students who were lucky enough to graduate in the few years before the recession hit. I think the parents of young kids during COVID are just never going to be quite like the people who hadn't, you know, yet quite had kids when COVID hit.
And you note that this is falling on parents of both sexes, but I assume the disproportionate burden of this is falling on mothers, right? That this is having a larger effect on their employment and how they're spending their time?
So initial evidence suggests yes. You know, there's been a big improvement in equality in the household, but when all of the work of caring for children and caring for the home now falls on parents. There's no more it's a huge reduction in outsourcing. This isn't even just about childcare, but maybe you don't have house cleaners coming in. You're not getting as many services to sort of support your household as you used to. So you have this huge increase in the amount of work that needs to be done at home. So if you had a 60-40 split before, now it's 60-40 of just a much bigger pie. And that's going to have a bigger impact on women's careers. It's also the case that if you have even just a slight 60-40, 55-45 split in childcare, the kids will tend to gravitate towards the person who's got the slightly bigger share when they have a problem. And I think we've seen that a lot with COVID, the kid who goes to mom first. And so I do think that this is going to raise gender gaps that are going to take a very long time to re-narrow to where we were in 2019.
So Dorian, I think about that problem in the context of school districts and states having to make decisions about school closures. And one thing that we're seeing is that there doesn't really seem to be a strong correlation between virus conditions and school reopening choices. What we're seeing is a strong correlation between school reopening choices and Trump vote, which is to say that more Democratic areas are making more conservative choices about keeping schools closed. And it seems to me there are parts of the country where the infection rate in the community is really quite low, and there should be probably more pressure for schools to reopen in those communities than we're seeing because of these effects that we're going to see in homes and because of the disproportionate effect that we're likely to see on lower income and minority families when the childcare aspect of schools is withdrawn from them. I'm surprised there isn't more backlash especially in parts of the Northeast where the virus is under relatively good control, saying that schools need to be more open.
I'm surprised, too, and I think we can expect there will be once there are new breakouts of cases, of folks testing positive and getting sick. So I think it's a fast-moving, and we're going to know in a month, right, in terms of if school districts that are choosing to reopen now without much backlash, they're going to quickly have to close, as we've seen in some places already. But on the broader issue of childcare, Josh, I just want to highlight a couple of things Betsy said. One is we had a childcare crisis before the pandemic, and now it's magnified, right? We can't have an economy to really function without childcare. And especially on the question of options, this is really, really important. Betsy said the options are terrible, and that is the supply side of things, right? There's this thing called childcare deserts, where approximately half of Americans live in areas with little or not licensed childcare capacity. That affects more than 4.5 million children. Then you add on top of that childcare workers themselves, who, by the way, can't afford childcare for their own children because they make too little money. And we also, on the other side of that, we actually have data around why investing in childcare, and I would say we need a $100 billion investment in childcare right now, especially for the children of essential workers. But when you invest in childcare, we saw one example in D.C. when D.C. started a universal pre-K program, women's participation in the city's workforce rose by 10%, which is essentially good news for everyone because when women join the labor force, wages rise, that goes into the economy grows. So this should be, I think childcare and schools should be the central issue right now that we are talking about after we stop the pandemic, after we stop the spread of the virus. But it is it's an issue whose time has come and that we have devalued primarily because it is women's work in this country, and we need to recenter it in this moment.
Megan, what do you make of that? Do we need a lot more public spending on childcare?
I think we have a real trade-off here, right? I mean, the reason that we're talking about this is that, unfortunately, certainly in Israel, schools have proven a good place to spread COVID. Overall, I think there's real questions. I think, first of all, I certainly, while wishing we didn't have the pandemic, I'm going to be super interested to see all of the natural experiments that are come out of this. Like, what do boosting savings with these really high unemployment benefits, what are households doing with that in 10 years, right? What is the effect of having people home during the pandemic? Is it the same as people who sort of withdraw from the labor force just in the normal course of the economy? But one thing to sort of ask is, look, if we push for people to have their kids outside the home so that they can work, and, you know, I don't have young kids, but I have a lot of friends who do, and I'm really, really sympathetic to that need. They can't get their jobs done. Their children aren't being socialized. It's a really hard choice for them and for governments, I think.
But if we do that and they become a locus of infection, then do we prolong the economic agony of having COVID spreading in the community? I don't think anyone knows the answer. I think at this point, we're all kind of feeling towards solutions. Some of them are really easy. Like, if you are reopening restaurants, you should be able to reopen schools. And if you are not having in-person dining inside, then, you know, maybe it's not safe to have schools open either. But on the larger questions of what is the right thing for families, what is the right thing for public health, I'm not sure it's as easy as like we should just be funding a lot of childcare right now. I think there are larger public health questions that if we answer those, we can sort of put off the childcare questions for later.
Betsy, how do you think about the human capital and education side of this, which is to say there are a lot of kids who may be facing essentially a year of in-person school instruction that they are not getting? What should we expect that will mean for their lifetimes? Will they just graduate high school later? Will they end up repeating grades? Will they graduate high school and college less skilled and have lower lifetime income? How much does it matter to interrupt the educational process like that for such a long period?
So what happens will depend on what we do, but we do know that the interruption comes at a cost. We've seen this from studies that have looked at localized closures due to things like hurricanes and natural disasters. And we know that it can take kids, you know, 4 or 5 years to get caught back up. But that's when, you know, they're not all, when it's not hitting every kid. So if we want to think about what this is going to do to kids, as I said, it's going to depend on what we do. I think what we'll have to do is increase spending on education. So I completely agree with Megan that do we need to increase funding for childcare right now? What we need to do is make sure that we're not losing childcare slots, that we're not losing teachers, that 55-year-old teacher that Megan talks about doesn't retire, because we don't want to lose all the experienced teachers and childcare workers who are, say, over the age of 50 because they're not willing to risk their life in order to go back to work. Childcare employment is down 20% right now. We need to hold on to the infrastructure we have. So that requires some spending today. But what I'd like to see, a big national spending plan for childcare, absolutely. And that's what's going to work to get women back to work and to invest more in early childhood education. But I think that comes in a post-COVID world, in a post-vaccine world, I should say. Right now, it's about preserving, doing the best we can to educate kids. I think we need to be doing a lot more to figure out which kids need to be prioritized. I don't know of any school district that's really doing that, that's saying, here are the kids of essential workers. We're going to open the schools for them. Sorry, the rest of you have to do virtual schooling. Or these are the kids who have particular learning needs, and we need to make some special accommodations for them. I think we need to be doing things that are much more focused on what are the needs of parents based on their work, what are the needs of kids, and understanding that we can't give everything everybody right now. And then we need a plan to catch everybody back up. And my biggest fear is state and local government finances mean we're going to see a reduction in staffing in the future, when what we really are going to need is a massive increase in staffing in order to do the remedial work to catch those kids up quickly.
So, Betsy, the decisions about this, we talk about the challenge for state and local government finances. Over the next several years, decisions about how they'll spend money is likely to be made in an environment where the economy is still climbing out of this, where that means weak tax revenue, that means pressure for spending cuts. And so how should people think about the returns on that spending if you're deciding, can we really afford this childcare program? Can we really afford to increase educational spending at this point? I mean, you talked some about those studies that look at how interruptions to education affect achievement, and that ultimately comes back as economic output as those children become adults and go to work. What about on the childcare side? Do we know about if we had a robust financial commitment to childcare, what would the economic returns to that be? I mean, I assume it would get more people into the workforce, right? So does that offset the cost of the childcare?
It more than offsets the cost. Investing in early childhood education is one of the best uses of taxpayer dollars in terms of bang for our buck. So, we know that from just a large number of experiments on early childhood education that when we spend money on that, we get it back in terms of higher workforce participation and higher earnings for the kids. And higher earnings, more work means they pay more back in terms of taxes. So that's definitely an investment worth making. And I just want to point out that in World War II, we passed a very low cost, high quality childcare program because we needed women to go into the factories because all the men were gone. And we've now, been able to study what happened to those kids over their life. And we saw that they worked more, they earned more, and they more than paid back the program. We ended that program when the war ended because it was funded under defense. It was, part of a defense industry. How do we get women into the factories? But I think we need to now say we've seen those studies. This is worth it. It is a lot of money, but I think we get more back from it than many other dollars we spend. And I think that's also going to be true for increasing our spending in K-12 education. We know that education still has an enormously high return. The more educated workers earn more, the returns to a college education have never been higher. We can back that out, though, and say that in general, the returns to learning have never been higher. And the only way we're going to be able to accomplish that is going to be to spend more on education, and exactly at a time, as you said, that when state and local governments aren't going to have the money. So I think we need to make a commitment as a nation to borrow for our children's sake. They'll be able to pay it back if we invest in them over the next 5 or 10 years.
Betsy Stevenson is a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan and host of the new podcast, Think Like an Economist. Betsy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I've been talking with Megan McArdle of The Washington Post and Dorian Warren of the Center for Community Change. When we come back, we'll talk about how the pandemic and the police protests have been affecting crime rates. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist of The Washington Post. On the left is Dorian Warren, president of the Center for Community Change. Many large cities across the U.S. have experienced a spike in murders and aggravated assaults over the last few months. Our next guest examined crime data from 27 major cities and found murder was up 37% in June. A key question with these crime trends is why? A lot of things are very unusual right now, and if murders are up for temporary reasons related to the pandemic, then some of these issues may just resolve themselves. But if the rise in murder and other violent crime is driven, for example, by reduced trust in the police, or is due to an enforcement pullback by police officers who are frustrated about protests, then we're going to have to figure out what to do about that even after the pandemic is over. To talk about what's driving crime and how we can address it, Richard Rosenfeld joins us now. Richard is the founder's professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. So first of all, for a while we've been hearing these anecdotal reports suggesting that certain kinds of crime were up. So what you're saying here is the national spike in the murder rate and also in the aggravated assault rate is real during COVID?
Yes, it's real. And it's statistically meaningful. What that means is that the uptick we've seen since late May through the end of June, which is when our study ended, in homicide and aggravated assault exceeds the uptick that occurred last year. So we're taking seasonal effects into account.
So ordinarily, crimes like this go up in the summer, but this has gone up even more than it normally would.
Exactly.
Do we know why?
No, not yet. We have explanations to guide that inquiry, and they come primarily, with a significant exception, they come from our experience about 5 years ago during the social unrest associated with the events in Ferguson, Chicago, Baltimore, New York City, and elsewhere. We saw a spike in homicide and also other violence during that period, and that was a period of marked social unrest. At the time, two explanations were offered, and they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. One, as you mentioned, was that the police were pulling back because of anger at criticism of the police, because of concerns about increased legal liability. The argument was the police were not fully engaged in their tasks and crime went up. The second argument, in effect, turns that first one on its head. And in this case, the argument is, in effect, the communities or certain communities, especially communities of color, are drawing further back from the police. And that means that people are not as willing as they once might have been to contact the police if they learn of a crime, not as willing to cooperate with the police in investigations, and perhaps more likely to take matters into their own hands when disputes arise. And that can contribute to the uptick in crime. My own view is that latter explanation probably is more valid than the former, though some mixture of the two was then quite possible. And I see those explanations as kind of leading our inquiry to figure out what may be causing the current uptick. But there is an exception, and the exception is the pandemic, specifically the social response to the pandemic. The response to the pandemic has affected police activity on the street, just as it has affected nearly all other kinds of activity. Many police officers are out on quarantine. Of those who remain on the job, they're subject to social distancing requirements. And social distancing on the street means that police officers cannot engage at the levels they once could have in the kinds of proactive policing activities that have been shown to reduce crime. They're not as likely to check pedestrians, check occupied vehicles, or unoccupied vehicles, not as likely to check buildings to make sure doors and windows are secure. And as a result, some of those activities that we know can help to reduce crime are simply occurring, perhaps, but at much reduced levels. That could be another contributor to the increase in violence that we've seen.
I've read with great interest, actually, Professor Rosenfeld, both your studies. There's the earlier study of the 64 cities and then the latter study of the 27. And in the earlier study, the news was that homicide rates declined in April and May, right? And that there was a prediction that opening the country back up, we would see an increase in rates, which I think your subsequent study did show that there's an increase. And so can you help us make, I had more questions actually, can you help us make sense of, like, one implication of your studies is that actually we should keep everything closed, because closing the economy actually results in a reduction in violent crime as opposed to an increase.
Well, I suppose that's, one among several logical implications. My own view is that we simply cannot afford to, quote, keep everything closed. What we have to do is respond effectively to the increase in violence that we're seeing. The difference in the results between the prior study that you mentioned and our current one is that the prior study ended at the end of May. Also, we were able to look just at homicide in the prior study, but for a larger sample of cities. But I think the primary reason why we don't find the same result, that is, we see violence going up through the end of June, but not through the end of May, is simply the difference in the time period, specifically when the time period ends.
One of your conclusions then is that this is a multi-pronged effort to, right? You talk about three different approaches. There's law enforcement, there's public health, there's community. And you make the point, which I think is really important, that part of violence reduction requires people to meet face-to-face. And I appreciated this line in the report. They cannot be replaced by Zoom. So Zoom fatigue goes beyond just our own individual fatigue. It can actually deal with the issues of crime. So I was curious if you could talk a bit more about that in terms of what the multifaceted approach requires to get a handle on violent crime, especially as it compares to previous years.
Yeah. Well, I think first and foremost, it requires on the part of city officials in those cities where the uptick is quite pronounced. A major public commitment to address the rise in violent crime and to bring all resources to bear. Now, that will be difficult while social distancing remains in effect, but it's not impossible. All resources must include the police, in my view, but cannot exclusively rely on the police. Community groups have an important role to play, both in assisting the police, but also in carrying out anti-violence activities of their own that are somewhat independent of police activity. Here I have in mind the use of so-called violence interrupters under a program that's widely known as Cure Violence. This is a pure community-based program that has persons who are trained in particular neighborhoods, who are familiar with those neighborhoods, to be on the lookout for conflict situations that could turn violent, and then to attempt to intervene and mediate in those situations. There's some past research showing this approach to be effective. Other research is somewhat more mixed, but it's a promising approach, and it is, you know, as I mentioned, a purely community-based approach. In some instances, Cure Violence works closely with the police, though it's independent of them. In other instances, the relationship is really quite distant. So that's one community-based approach. Hospital-based approaches carried out by physicians and public health workers that interview people who have been shot in the hospital and attempt to obtain information about the circumstances of the shooting, but also provide people with services and supports that might put them on a different path. Those approaches also are quite effective. So there you have public health, social service, medical interventions, community-based interventions, police interventions in the form of so-called targeted policing, which has been shown to be quite effective in reducing crime. All three have to be tried. I wouldn't move down one of those paths to the exclusion of the others.
Yeah, you know, I think that one of the big problems right now, aside from, I mean, actually there are multiple problems, you know, one is that this is not a great time to start innovative crime control initiatives simply because state and local governments have quite a lot on their hands already and they're looking at cash shortfalls. But I think another problem is that the police feel beleaguered and that they have been treated like hostile forces, often by their own, you know, mayors and governors. And that's not a good time to try to get them to cooperate with what will have to be a kind of friendly cooperative effort. And that is, you do need the police to be in on this. You need them to be enthusiastic. And the way that the protests were framed, and I am not saying that, you know, that the protesters were not justified in their anger. Police abuse is a real and huge problem in this country. We desperately need to rethink the way we police communities from the ground up. But the fact is that having expressed that righteous anger in the way it was, which was extraordinary hostility to the police, we're not in a good place now to try to bring them on board with a let's rethink how you do your job in order to reduce violence while not being so punitive and abusive towards the communities you're in.
So, Richard, how do you approach that? I mean, I think a lot of the complaints that protesters have had around the country are very reasonable, but maybe even more importantly, they're very real. They reflect sentiment that is in the community. So how do you simultaneously address very real public concerns about policing while getting the police to be productive stakeholders in a process of trying to control crime?
It is a fair point that to the degree that the police are angered, frustrated in the face of criticism, that they may not be fully engaged in carrying out tasks that can help to reduce crime. Having said that, however, none of these programs that I've been describing and others have described require that every single officer in the department become enthusiastic about their implementation. In every police department, there are more than a sufficient number of officers who really are committed to policing in a fair and equitable way. and are open to changes in policing, the reallocation or sharing of certain police functions with other personnel, other agencies. There are a sufficient number of rank and file officers, not to mention police officials, who are open to those discussions, that it seems to me that's not, you know, officer morale, quote unquote, is not or should not be a major impediment to moving forward. In my view, moving forward has to include not only effectively addressing the violence, but also opening the conversation and implementing changes where needed in police activity. Now, it strikes me there's common ground here to join forces between rank and file police officers and their union representatives and critics of the police. Rank and file officers will often say, and I've dealt with lots over my career, hey, we're not social workers. That's not how we were trained. These tasks have, in a sense, been forced on us because we're the only game left in town in many neighborhoods. Well, precisely so. That's what many of the critics are saying. You're not trained as social workers. Why not begin the process, and I would say very deliberately and carefully, of trying to reallocate some of those tasks that are better performed by social workers or public health advocates, caseworkers. One would be dealing with mental health issues among the homeless. Or personnel of an entirely different stripe. We deploy police officers to monitor traffic, monitor crowds at big crowd events, should they ever return. Baseball games, football games, other, you know, concerts, that sort of thing. It's never been clear to me why we need to take officers off crime control functions in order to engage in the activity. I've always wondered why fire personnel, our other kind of front line of public safety officers, fire personnel could not, with a minimum of training, be deployed to those kinds of events. There are all kinds of ways, it seems to me, to open the dialogue between rank and file officers, their own officials, city officials, and the general public to move forward. I'm not suggesting it's going to be easy, but I do not think we're going to be successful in effectively reducing violent crime, at least over the next several months, unless we also, in a good faith way, engage in police reform.
Richard Rosenfeld, Founders Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We have reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Megan McArdle, it's your soapbox.
The controversies over school closures are an example of a larger problem that's beset us throughout this pandemic, which is that we keep fighting the last battle instead of preparing for the next. Some of that's unavoidable. The virus keeps changing on us, but we need to do a better job of anticipating the problems we're going to have and hashing out the inevitable hard decisions we'll have to make in order to solve them. Most notably, we need to be preparing public health agencies and the public for the difficulties that are going to surround vaccination campaigns if and when a vaccine is available. That means the logistical challenges facing those public health agencies are unprecedented in the history of American public health, of getting the entire country vaccinated on a reasonably orderly schedule. But also, we need to be educating the public already about what is happening with these vaccines development, about showing them that, in fact, safety is being is still the number one priority of the FDA, and making sure that people are not too afraid to get the vaccine when it comes.
Dorian Warren, what's on your mind?
Well, the cameras have gone away, as have many reporters, but the protests continue on the streets in cities and suburbs across America. And yes, even in Portland, where the news media was present while the president sent in unidentified federal agents, the protests against injustice continue. We even have Oprah Winfrey going up with billboards in Louisville, Kentucky, to support protesters' efforts to bring the police officers involved in Breonna Taylor's death to justice. And yes, if you missed it, they're still free. If it bleeds, it leads is the mantra of most news media. But months of thousands of Americans engaging in nonviolent protests day after day after day seems to be, I don't know, boring to most of the news media. Not interested. If it's not riots or property damage, it's not newsworthy. So listen, folks, the protests haven't stopped. The local efforts to reconstruct our economy and our democracy, and yes, police, continue. You may look away, but change is a-coming, and it is here.
For my rant, the president wants the Chinese company ByteDance to sell social media app TikTok to an American buyer. There are valid national security concerns about the Chinese owning such a popular social media app on so many Americans' phones, and the president may have the legal authority to make this happen sooner or later. What he does not have the authority to do is demand a finder's fee. But he's doing that anyway, saying there should be a major payment to the U.S. Treasury if likely buyer Microsoft gets its hands on TikTok, since, after all, President Trump is the one who made the Chinese sell in the first place. We used to think it was a problem for presidents to make such ad hoc interventions in the market, but now everyone smiles and nods, I guess because Microsoft figures Biden will be president by the time a deal closes anyway. But this is not what the government is supposed to do. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Dorian Warren, Megan McArdle, Betsy Stevenson, and Richard Rosenfeld. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
From PRX.